Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the headlines this week, President Obama lays out his budget. Tough decisions ahead.
We're not going to be running up the credit card anymore. That's important, and that's hard to do.
And it's not just the federal budget. In Wisconsin, thousands protest a bill that would strip most public workers there of their right to unionize. Here's a teacher.
Taking away our rights and our collective bargaining that we've had for years. This is the right of Wisconsin workers. This is the things that we fought for and that we believe in.
And in the Middle East, the protests roll across Iran, Iraq, Libya, Yemen, and here in Bahrain, where the government cracked down hard. This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Margaret Tolov, White House correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, Jonathan Broder, senior defense and foreign policy editor for Congressional Quarterly, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Hello to all three of you, and thanks a lot for joining us. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? Are you following the budget battle, the protests in the Middle East? You can also comment on our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. First to the Middle East. On Tuesday, lawmakers in the Iranian parliament angrily called for the execution of opposition leaders in the wake of this week's anti-government protests. Jonathan Broder, the angry shouts there. What are you seeing across the region?
Well, what you're seeing is really something quite extraordinary. You're seeing basically a population that has been under the thumb of either autocratic governments or monarchical governments, or in the case of Iran, a theocracy. They're basically fed up with their lack of job opportunities, their lack of political freedom, and something has snapped. You know, revolutions are very odd things. I mean, you go from peaceful one day to a point where something just snaps and people lose their fear. And what you're seeing across the Middle East, in Libya, Iran, Yemen, Bahrain, is people challenging the authority that they've been under for so long. And we don't know where this is going to lead, but this is a genie that is not going to go back in the bottle anytime soon.
The unrest in Iran follows the ouster of Egyptian President Mubarak following the protests by anti-government protesters in Egypt. Jonathan, you write in Congressional Quarterly this week that it's far from certain the Obama administration will come out down the line as one of the winners of the Egyptian revolution. What do you mean by that?
Well, Hosni Mubarak was in power for 30 years, and he was a very, very close ally of the United States, very much doing the United States' bidding when it came to the war against terrorists. He had signed a peace treaty, or his predecessor signed a peace treaty with Israel back in 1979. He scrupulously observed that peace treaty. And don't forget that Egypt also controls the Suez Canal. What will probably happen, I mean, it's very dangerous to make predictions here because we don't know where the Egyptian revolution is going to end up. But I would assume that at least in the short term, the Egyptians will maintain their commitment to the peace treaty with Israel because it's good for Egypt as well. It saves them a lot of money and troops that they don't have to put on that border. But on issues that are also important to America, for example, support for Hamas, which is the group that is leading the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, we might not expect the Egyptians to be as friendly to the United States in those kind of policies.
Let's talk about Bahrain, where there have been deadly clashes between anti-government protesters and riot police. Tensions heightened today because of the funerals of some of the protesters. Speaking with CNN, Bahraini activist Zaina Farda described the violence that the country's police have used against the protesters this week.
And then they set the tent on fire. It went up in flames around us. My six-year-old grabbed onto me and said, "Mommy, Mommy, call the police." And I had to say to her, "It's the police that is doing this to us."
Margaret Tolov, what's been the attitude in Washington to the spreading of the protests across the Middle East and at least this crackdown?
It is one of extreme caution in terms of trying to calibrate and constantly recalibrate what position the Obama administration is taking. And you heard the president days ago talk about this. He's trying to strike a balance where he is saying, "I'm on the side of, you know, people who want basic freedoms," but they keep reiterating that each country is different. And the reason why they keep reiterating is that the calculus is really different in every place. I think it's exactly as you both said, that there are real concerns that even if, you know, while the broader cause of democracy is something to hope for, that you don't know what exactly you're going to get, what the implications will be. And what the president said the other day is that he's telling these leaders, essentially, hey, if you're our friends, if you're our allies, we may not be able to help you once the genie's out of the bottle. Try to get ahead of your people. Try to anticipate how to keep things calm.
The U.S. fleet is based in Bahrain, the regional fleet. It's a hugely strategically important place for the U.S. What's at stake for the U.S. there?
Absolutely. Well, the Navy's Fifth Fleet, you know, is the basis of the forces for the Persian Gulf, for the Red Sea, for the Arabian Sea, for East Africa, to monitor piracy, to keep oil flowing. The implications are huge, and there are also implications with regard to Iran. I mean, let's be honest. The U.S. has a much more vested interest in bolstering and sort of holding together opposition against Iran and keeping Iran in check than it does emboldening the toppling of regimes which could then empower Iran. So that's part of what's going on here with Bahrain. And in Bahrain, you see this split between the Sunnis, who are the royalty, and the controlling party, who are the Shiites. It's very complicated.
Jack Beatty, it's a question that I want to get at in this way. Is it an overstatement in your view or not to say that three of our biggest Middle East initiatives are at risk right now? The containment of Iran, the defeat of al-Qaeda, the free flow of oil out of the region.
That's a big bill, Bob. I don't know. We might put it another way, that our essential objective is on the rise in the Middle East, namely democracy. Quite apart from our economic interests, that is our, you know, that's the, that used to be the guiding star of our foreign policy. It hasn't been now for a generation. We've made deals with these potentates. They have served us and haven't served their people. Now their people are rising up. And notice how this is really giving the lie to 10 years of really defamation of Arabs and Muslims. Oh, they don't want democracy. They're history's objects. They can't take the helm. They're passive. All they care about is justice, not freedom. All of that is just now in the discard. And to me, the statement of this week is from an Iraqi demonstrator. He said, "Are we expecting violence? Yes, we are expecting violence. Are we going to go out in it? Yes, we're going out." That's the voice of civic courage. That's the voice the United States, in essential interests, should encourage.
Bob, if I could just jump in.
Go ahead,
Jonathan.
For a
second and add something. I think we have to take a look at what U.S. policy has been basically since the end of World War II. Because of the enormous importance of oil from the Middle East to the United States, one of the pillars of U.S. policy in the Middle East has been support for Saudi Arabia and in an ancillary fashion, the other oil-rich emirates in the Persian Gulf, so the UAE, Kuwait, etc. The other pillar of U.S. policy since 1948 has been support for the State of Israel. Now, up until now, the United States has, in varying degrees of success, been able to sort of skate between Arab animosity toward Israel and support for Israel. And so in other words, it's been straddling both close ties with the Arabs, but again, these autocratic regimes, and close ties with Israel. I think what you're beginning to see now is the grip that those autocratic regimes have had up until now is beginning to unravel. And it is going to have profound implications for U.S. policy. If U.S. policy doesn't change, events on the ground may force it to change.
So does that mean, Jonathan, that you think that the U.S. will need to get closer to Israel because it may be eventually the only stable government left in the region?
Well, I think what one has to realize is that Israel, the issue of Israel is not just a foreign policy issue. Relations with the Middle East, with Iraq, with Iran, Bahrain, all of those issues are foreign policy issues. The issue of Israel, I would argue, is a domestic political issue. Israel supporters in Congress are immensely powerful. And even if a president would want to try to change policy toward Israel, to try to strike a more even-handed balance between support for Israel and trying to meet some of the demands of the Arabs, they will have, whatever administration that is, will have an extremely difficult time because of the strength of Israel supporters in the Congress.
Margaret, your take on this very briefly?
I think prospects for Mideast peace were not looking real good before, and they're not looking real good now. And I thought that President Obama tried to put the best spin on the issue by talking about how if younger Arabs and Muslims feel empowered by the rise of democracy in their countries, maybe they'll be less likely to take it out on Israel. And, I guess hope is important, but I think you could just as easily go the other way.
I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the week in the news with Margaret Tolove, White House correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, Jonathan Broder, defense and foreign policy editor for Congressional Quarterly, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Let's continue talking about the Middle East for at least the next few minutes and bring an On Point listener to the discussion. Saeed is calling from Westford, Massachusetts. Saeed, hello.
Hi, Bob. How are you today? I have a comment regarding about Bahrain's protest. I just got Twitter from live from Bahrain, and people are saying it. Police are using live ammo. They killed several people, and also they are torturing people in a hospital, and a lot of people are disappearing all of a sudden. And it is time to, we should openly support the protesters and stop supporting dictators and thugs. This is for our benefit, for we are not creating any hatred. We will not create any hatred. And also, we cannot support this kind of behavior where the human rights is violated. So I'll just leave it on you.
Saeed, thank you very much. Margaret, let me ask you, what's the challenge for the White House? How does it balance the stated desire for people to pursue democracy while at the same time trying to stay supportive of governments which have been somewhat or very repressive?
Right. I mean, I think the balance in some cases may be dictated by the other country, in this case, Bahrain. I think in the case of Egypt, the administration was pretty cautious at first about criticizing Mubarak, and they felt that he had pushed them, and the protesters, conversely, had, you know, risen up to a level of legitimacy where they couldn't sort of straddle the fence anymore. And if this sort of if these patterns worsen in Bahrain, the administration may be forced into a position that they don't want to take. As of yesterday, the White House was telling us that President Obama himself had not spoken directly with the Bahrain leader since the uprising in Cairo began. But we know that Vice President Biden has spoken as recently as 4 or 5 days ago with the king, and the administration did not read that out. And what I take away from that is that the White House did not want to broadcast publicly the elements of that conversation, either because it was a very tough conversation and they don't want to embarrass Bahrain, or because it was a conversation that went nowhere fast and they don't want to reveal that, or possibly both. It's very what's going on behind closed doors right now is really not transparent. I mean, we're trying to gauge precisely how hard the U.S. is leaning on Bahrain outside of public discussion.
Jack Beatty, some say that there are indications from the White House that President Obama wants to be on the right side of history in the Middle East. Is it possible to be on the right side of history regarding human rights, if that's your view of the right side of history, but be on the wrong side for present U.S. interests there, namely access to oil, overall security in the Middle East?
I'm sure that's a possibility. That's a scenario, and you hear this kind of thing. But the opposite argument, I think, is it really has more going for it, and people have made it. It is that agreements made by autocrats are just really reflect what they want, not what their people want. Agreements entered into by democracies, say Egypt gets a democracy, they ratify the peace treaty with Israel, that agreement is on firmer foundation. It has the consent of the people behind it, or there's an effort to persuade the people. So in that sense, I think our treaty commitments out there, our defense commitments, our necessity for oil and the like, all of this, it would be on better footing if it were rooted in popular consent. If the people in the region said, yeah, we'll do business with the United States, rather than just their rulers saying it.
Jonathan Broder, should the White House be thinking history at all while these protests continue to roil day after day, hour after hour?
You know, history is still being written. My sense is that it may be too late for the United States to be on the right side of history. As I said before, their policy has been to support these autocrats for the past several decades, and the people in these countries know that. I mean, if you travel out to the region, the United States doesn't have a lot of credibility out there when it comes to democracy promotion. If you remember, George Bush gave a very stirring speech, and Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State, also gave a very stirring speech out in Cairo that, you know, for all these years we have sought both stability and friendship in the Middle East, and we have achieved neither, or stability and democracy in the Middle East, and we have achieved neither. The people have not forgotten that George Bush very quickly abandoned that that goal. I mean, it was a rhetorical goal, but he never did really anything about it. He insisted that there be elections in the Palestinian territories in 2006, and look who won. Hamas won. Hamas is listed as a terrorist organization by the United States. So even though they won an election that the United States insisted that the Palestinian territories conduct, as soon as Hamas won, the United States refused to have anything to do with Hamas.
Ralph is calling from Arlington, Mass. Hi, Ralph. You're on Point.
Yes. Hi, Bob. Well, I'm cautiously optimistic about the democracy movements in general, specifically more in Egypt than Bahrain, seeing as how the Bahrainis, the king first apologized for two of his people killing two protesters, and then a few days later, another four get killed at least. So, I know Secretary Clinton is trying to exert her influence to make them not be violent, but what leverage does she really have? I mean, is there something we haven't heard about yet that, you know, they can do? Like, I mean, I'm sure they offer the Bahrainis a lot of financial assistance. Maybe, how much of a lever is that?
Margaret Tallov, what can the U.S. do? What can Secretary of State Clinton do?
Well, one major reason why Bahrain looks to the United States is for protection against Iran. But look, these are really, I just don't see, what are we going to say, right? I mean, and here's part of the problem. These are sovereign nations. And with the toppling of each regime, you know, the stakes get higher, because with each successive victory by the, you know, civil protesters, it emboldens a spread of this. And I'm just not sure that the Obama administration wants a domino effect in the Middle East of the sudden toppling of a bunch of governments. I mean, it could really become chaotic. And I think part of the problem is the administration really doesn't know what it wants, because none of the choices are a sure thing, or even kind of a sure thing. There are a million possible unintended consequences.
Okay. From the turmoil in the Middle East, now let's move to a different subject, the sharp debate over the federal budget up on Capitol Hill. President Obama unveiled his budget on Monday. Here he is speaking at the Parkville Middle School and Center for Technology in Baltimore about the need to continue to invest in the future, even while making cuts.
Education is an investment that we need to win the future, just like innovation is an investment that we need to win the future, just like infrastructure is an investment that we need to win the future. And to make sure that we can afford these investments, we're going to have to get serious about cutting back on those things that would be nice to have, but we can do without. That's what families across the country do every day. They live within their means, and they invest in their families' futures. It's time we did the same thing as a country.
President talking about the budget earlier this week when he unveiled it. Margaret Tolov, what are some of the cuts the president is proposing in his budget? Cuts that have been roundly criticized already, almost even before the president unveiled them by Republicans.
Oh, I thought you wanted to talk about Democrat cuts, because the president has some problems from within his own party with some of the cuts that, like to the low-income assistance.
Federal fuel assistance, which is sharply criticized by Northeast Democrats, liberals from the Northeast, who are usually President Obama's chief allies.
Well, that's exactly right. But he has to put something up there in order to show that he's a good faith player, and he probably assumes that they're going to lose this stuff anyway, so it's not worth fighting that hard about it. And then there are some of the increases. We probably shouldn't do too much of this on public radio, but such as his proposed increase of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting budget. So there are, I think this budget is much more significant for the cuts that it doesn't make than for the cuts that it does propose to make.
Well, in fact, you wrote this week that President Obama's budget plan avoided the big challenges. What do you mean?
Well, certainly the entire entitlements issue, which is... Most of the rest of this, I'm not saying it's not important, but it's largely trimming around the edges. The big problem, what's really driving up the debt over the long term, are programs like Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and are the long-term implications of extending and extending and extending tax cuts and of paying for war. And, they just extended the tax cuts. The president specifically did not come out and propose his own plan, didn't sort of want to move first and put out the Obama plan for entitlement reform. As he said, he doesn't think it would be effective. As the Republicans say, how can we take you seriously when, you're the president of the country and you're not willing to put out a plan? So part of this is the art of negotiation. He who puts out the first plan loses, that's the premise. But but part of it is like, okay, so we're looking at the president saying that he's really getting serious about the issues, but we're looking at the debt still doubling over the next decade if this plan were signed off on.
Jack Beatty, you look at this all the time. What weigh in here?
Well, I applaud the president's priorities. I mean, he wants to increase education spending by 11% just this year alone, and he wants to make more investments in green energy, and he would pay for that by cutting back on subsidies to oil, gas, and coal companies over the next decade. All that is fine and prudent. What bothers me is the president had a chance, I think, to tell a story to the American people. The story is, how did we get into this mess? And he didn't tell it. I mean, the big driver of the mess, in addition to the things Margaret mentioned, of course, is the recession. Well, how did the recession happen? Well, who's to blame for that? Where are the taxes, for example, on the hedge funders? Where is the Tobin tax on speculation on Wall Street? Where are the cuts in agricultural subsidies? Where are the cuts in the ethanol subsidy? Where are the, the lobbied powers, and spending in the government? None of that he went after. Instead, it's just sort of small ball. And he missed a chance, I think, to really say to the people, look, we can't have these lobbyists just reaching into the federal till anymore. The days of subsidies to private industry are over. We're going to begin anew. All that is gone. Instead, he's, in a way, entered the discussion with the Republicans, who what do they want to do? They want to cut pretty much everything, including infant formula for poor women. I mean, do they have to pay for this recession? I'm sorry the president missed that opportunity.
Well, let's talk about the what the Republicans are saying about this. In an interview with Politico's Mike Allen, Republican Congressman Paul Ryan, chairman of the House Budget Committee, criticized the president's budget plan this week.
We believe it's important that we give our country more prosperity, that we give the country the chance of having real economic growth, and that we give the next generation a better future. You can't have that if you accelerate our path toward a debt crisis, okay, which is what the president's budget does.
Margaret Talov, the Republican leadership has been talking about the president's budget all this week. What's the most serious thing that they've said, do you think?
That they might shut down the government. I think that's the most serious threat that they're putting on the table. But I think it's as much a threat to their own party's leadership as it is to the Democrats and to the president.
Well, let's ask the government shutdown question directly. Are Democrats and Republicans so at loggerheads already in the budget process, which has only been underway for a week? Are they so at heads that a government shutdown is likely, Margaret?
I mean, my gut instinct tells me no, that Republicans don't want to go back down that road. But it is true that there are many, 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 you know, dozens, 87 or so newly elected Republicans in the House, that they want results. They want to get people's attention, and they're willing to, you know, crack a couple heads to make it happen. And so while my instinct says no, that this is going to be averted, day by day by day, the continued drumbeat, the continued threat that this could happen tells me that it would be foolish to say, no way, it's not going to happen.
Jim is calling from Omaha. Hi, Jim, you're on.
Thanks for taking my call. I waited until somebody said this to call. Social Security is not part of the deficit problem. Social Security is lumped together with other so-called entitlement programs. Social Security is the only government program that has actually been funded for decades by people like myself who expect to get it. So when I hear people like Margaret, who is on the radio as an expert about this, state that, I don't know whether she's just uninformed or lying about it. And I hear the same line repeated ad infinitum across the airwaves. It is absolutely incorrect. And as long as people start talking about it with that premise, they absolutely will not come to a solution.
Okay, Jim, I think we got it. Margaret, why don't you weigh in and respond?
Okay, well, I wasn't trying to lie. I was trying to oversimplify something, and I apologize. You know, ultimately, if we're overspending and we're taking money out of the pot that's supposed to be reserved for Social Security when people are paying into a system that was meant to help people in just, you know, their final couple of years of life, and we've now come to live decades after retirement, it all adds up to a problem. And it's true that the real deficit drivers are Medicare, Medicaid, not in and of itself Social Security, but the way that it has fit over the years into the long-term flow of money in and out of government.
Jack Beatty, if the president didn't move to deal with the big questions, entitlements, whether you put Social Security in that package or not, does it leave open the question of whether the president intentionally invited a budget showdown? Is this part of White House strategy?
Well, that's Machiavellian, isn't it? I mean, because that would put the Republicans essentially, they'd be the return of the repressed. They'd be back to 1995 when they really were hurt by the government shutdown. The public blamed them. Does Obama want that? I don't think he wants the government to shut down. He certainly wants the Republicans to be hurt. And this week, your surmise was actually floated by the Financial Times. They wondered aloud, is that what he wants, the Republicans to go out and shut the government down and lose? You know, there is an ace in the hole here, and that is that the senators who were the three Republican senators who were on the deficit commission all signed up for the deficit reduction program, which included more taxes. And that, and even as we speak, presumably, senators are meeting to talk about a big, big compromise. So that's still out there. Meanwhile, we have to get over these current hurdles.
I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, great slugger Albert Pujols may be a free agent after this season. Cardinals chairman William DeWitt tried to keep a positive attitude.
If he, in the end, doesn't stay a Cardinal, which we'll make every effort to make sure he does, we'll be out there trying to win divisions and championships just like we have for the last 15 years.
In the battle of man versus machine, it came down to Final Jeopardy this week and 19th century novelists.
Now we come to Watson. We're looking for Bram Stoker. And we find, who is Bram Stoker?
Sorry, Justin Bieber fans. Jazz singer and bassist Esperanza Spalding got the Best New Artist Award at the Grammys.
You're the winter sun. Ooh, baby, my naked branches in all the light. You're the winter sun. I know soon you'll come.
Baby, jazz artist Esperanza Spalding. Another big week in the news. With us today to help make sense of it all are Jonathan Broder from Congressional Quarterly, Margaret Tallove from the McClatchy Newspapers, and our own Jack Beattie. Let's stay on a budget issue for a moment, if I can. Jonathan, defense spending. What should we make of the move in the GOP-controlled House this week to shoot down funding for that controversial backup jet engine for, I think it's the F-35 fighter jet, a program supported by the House Speaker John Boehner, but shot down by basically the Tea Party-led Republicans in the House.
Basically, the second engine for the F-35 was what everyone recognizes as low-hanging fruit. There's already, you know, the first engine. There are many very successful warplanes that we've used that have had only one engine. And the second engine was essentially a luxury. I mean, there are many compelling arguments to have a second engine, the biggest one being that when you have two manufacturers competing against one another in engine production, costs come down and it saves the taxpayer money. But that engine, a second engine, which would have been built by GE and Rolls-Royce, and that's why you've got Boehner supporting it, because there's a GE plant that would be making components for it in his state. In the end, it's a luxury. And what I think is the unspoken news here is that, with the exception of that engine, Republicans don't want to see any other cuts to the defense budget. There's been talk of cutting a new combat vehicle for the Marines, which would cost $15 billion, which is their entire acquisition budget. Lawmakers where that vehicle would be built are dead set against it. And defense contractors are very smart in the way that they've done business. They've spread the manufacture of these weapon systems through pretty much every state in the union. So they get a lot of support on Capitol Hill for resisting cuts.
All right, let's talk about Wisconsin, if we can, on the subject of budget cutting and the huge public employee protests that have been taking place in the capital, Madison, because of a proposal that the governor there has put on the table. Under the plan, public employees would have to contribute more for health care and their pensions, but the backbreaker, say the unions, is the plan that calls for unions to lose rights to negotiate contracts. Union busting, they call it. It's been described as the nation's most aggressive anti-union proposal. This morning, on the CBS Early Show, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker said that his proposed bill would not eliminate protections for public workers.
Our workers have protections today. They'll have protections after this bill passes. What you've got are union leaders who don't like the fact that they're not going to be able to mandatorily enforce that every one of the workers here in state and local government have got to be a part of the union.
Jack Beattie, what's behind this? Is this a legitimate effort to solve a serious state budget problem in Wisconsin, or are those who back this in Wisconsin sensing that the opening exists now to crack the back of public employee unions? Is that the primary motivation?
I think both motives are there. According to reporting in Wisconsin papers, there is not a serious budget crisis in Wisconsin, and that if Wisconsin has a deficit this year, it's due to the governor's only been in office for a short time. But in that short time, he's already given out all sorts of money and subsidies to various Republican interest groups, basically. And that's the deficit. And so he's asking the public employees union to pay for that. But he's not. Now, if he were just saying pay more for your pensions, pay more for your health care, that's one thing. it's the limit on the right of collective bargaining that really makes this a dramatic moment. If he can get by with this, and of course now we know the Democratic senators to deny him a quorum have gone to places unknown, they're hiding. But if he can get away with this, Republicans in Idaho, Tennessee, Indiana, and Ohio, who are all poised to do similar things, will do them. And, you know, this is really a crucial moment for American labor and for the Democratic Party. The White House is mobilizing. The White House is using Facebook and Twitter and everything else to get people to some of these demonstrations. The president has weighed in on it. They see what this means. You know, in the 1980s, Governor Cuomo in his diaries wrote that the genius of Reaganism, its political genius anyway, was to separate the poor from the middle class by essentially saying the poor were dependent and they're taking your money. Now the Republicans, I think, have seen another opportunity, and that is to split the middle class, to split private sector middle class workers who are straitened, who are paying more for their pensions and so on, against public sector workers. And they're saying, these guys are getting away with everything while you're having to give up so much. And it just so happens, of course, the Democratic Party's largest funders are those public sector unions. So there are issues of fairness here, also of party money, and it's a dramatic moment, I think, in American, really, labor relations.
Jack, let me ask you this. Do you think that public employees need to start looking over their shoulders across the nation if this Wisconsin thing succeeds?
Oh, there's no question about it. I mean, I mentioned those other states that are looking at this kind of thing, and you know, Governor Christie in New Jersey is really becoming the voice of this. He's attacking specifically the teachers union, and he's making much of the skyscraper in Trenton that the teachers union has, and saying, "Look, that's what they're doing with their money." And, you know, even middle-class folks who are sympathetic to unions and who are having a hard time paying their bills, they look at some of these benefits for state workers and they say, I would like that. And so it sets up this kind of politics of envy, as I say, within the middle class. And it's a very, for organized labor, which is practically disappeared in the private sector, what, 9%? Its only growth has been in the public sector. Now Scott Walker and other Republican governors are poised to go after that beachhead.
Carl is calling from Nashville. Hi, Carl, you're on Point.
Well, my thing about this, the Wisconsin situation with the people up there that's executing, exercising their First Amendment right, it is as American as apple pie baseball and Jersey Shore. And I find it absolutely amazing how Republicans and conservatives, how they love to praise middle America, and they love to praise Midwestern values. But now all of a sudden, real middle Americans and real Midwestern values taking form of Wisconsin. And on the right, they've been demonizing. That is the top of hypocrisy. And on a purely personal note, Mr. Banner, I enjoy NPR. I love all the programmers on NPR. Please keep your partisan hands off my NPR. And for please, God's sake, man, put down Big Bird. Have a good weekend.
Carl, thank you a lot. Margaret Tolliff, why don't you weigh in here? What do you think's behind what's happening in Wisconsin? And is this a movement? And I asked the question because of this. Even some Democrats, such as former Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell, are suggesting that public pensions are breaking some states. So I think the question is, beyond the rhetoric and the talking points, is this a movement?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is important to talk about this on two levels. One is the politics. I'm not going to say there's no politics involved in this. Look at some of the states with electoral implications: Wisconsin, Ohio, maybe Indiana, if you want to get ambitious for the Democrats. But look, this is parallel in some ways to the earlier caller's concerns about his Social Security and the fact that he, you know, has been paying into a system and expects to be taken care of. And the public employees are, you know, some of the luckiest people in America when you, in terms of what they can expect when they get older, what they can expect when they retire, can they expect to be taken care of, or at least under the current system. And, you know, for Americans who work in the private sector, you're living longer, but you know that Social Security is probably not going to be worth what you once expected it to be. You know that they may delay your ability to receive various benefits. You know that your pension may disappear. But public employees have been able to count on all these things, and they are just as expensive to provide for the public employees. And the longer we live and the more medical treatments that are available, the more expensive it becomes. There's absolutely a legitimacy to the argument that that this needs to be tackled and probably reined in. The question is by what degree, and is there an additional ulterior motive to do away with unions? And it's that sort of space in the middle that is the politics. But I don't think you can argue that this isn't a long-term fiscal concern in every state.
Jonathan Broder, I think that leads to this question. Considering that national unions are sending representatives to Wisconsin to help wage the state fight there, how much of what happens in Wisconsin might actually set the tone for what we all expect to be the coming Capitol Hill debate over the big programs that special interests will rally around in Washington when we're talking about programs like Social Security and Medicare, do you think?
Well, I think that you're going to see the same. You're going to see very, very fierce battles in Washington over these issues. I can talk about defense, but the defense budget is by far the largest chunk of federal spending and the largest chunk of discretionary spending. And as I mentioned before, a lot of the contracting has been spread out in the states so that every state has, and every representative of every state has a vested parochial interest in defending those defense programs because it means jobs back home. So you get situations like this. The Pentagon, for years now, has said we do not need any more C-17 cargo planes. We've got more than enough. Now, these planes provide a lot of jobs. So what happens is that administrations, successive administrations, submit a budget to Congress, and there is no money requested for C-17s. And then when you got to remember that the budget or that the appropriations are decided by Congress, not by the president. The president makes a request, but the Congress decides it. Lo and behold, when the House and Senate Appropriations Defense Subcommittees pass their bills, there is millions and hundreds of millions of dollars for these 17 planes, and it's because of the power of these of parochial politics.
Jack Beattie, I'm wondering if we can draw a line between the debate over defense spending in Washington, the debate over the budget cuts that some say threaten unions in Wisconsin, and the huge protests in Wisconsin. Can we draw a line between them and Cairo and the Middle East and the huge anti-government protests taking place for the last couple of weeks?
Well, as a matter of fact, David Obey, the longtime Wisconsin congressman who retired last week, said when people, he was quoted today saying, when people were asking where Mubarak was, whether he had gone to Sharm el Sheikh or Paris, I was saying he was ensconced in the governor's mansion in Madison. That's his view, that Scott Walker, Scott Walker is the Mubarak of Wisconsin. Isn't it something? I don't know what the numbers, but it sounds like the largest demonstrations that we're aware of in the world took place in Madison, Wisconsin. Big as these demonstrations in the Arab world this week were, I don't know that they reached 25,000 people.
Well, let me ask you, what do you think the most important thing is that we should watch for out of Wisconsin at this moment?
Well, eventually these Democratic senators have got to come back. Now, the governor said that he's going to somehow use the National Guard if he has to. I don't know what that means. Does that mean to coerce the legislators back? Does that mean to take the place of state employees? Is he using that as a kind of threat? But they're going to have to come back, and I think – and the Democrats say they will negotiate about givebacks on pensions and more contributions to health care. They will not, sit by and have workers lose their collective bargaining rights. So It sounds like the governor is either going to have to give way, or he could become the new Calvin Coolidge of the of conservative America. As we remember, Cal Coolidge became famous in the Boston police strike for, you know, standing up for no right to strike against the public. Well, no one's going to strike against the public in Wisconsin, but he's effectively saying there's no right to have collective bargaining in the public sector.
Bottom line, Margaret Talov, will Wisconsin, do you think, which was, I believe, the first state to allow collective bargaining for public employees, will Wisconsin be the first state to abolish it?
Boy. Do I have to guess? I think that the public employees can probably expect at least to take a haircut out of all of this. And I think in pocketbook terms, that's going to be a much more real concern to most rank-and-file workers. And I think that the severity of what happens in Wisconsin will be a roadmap for what happens in other states.
Margaret Talov, White House correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hey, it's my pleasure, Bob.
Jonathan Broder, senior defense and foreign policy editor for Congressional Quarterly, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And Jack Beatty, always good to talk to you. Have a very good weekend.
Thank you, Bob.
We want to say that today is the last day for a while of tireless On Point producer Marika Spence, who's headed out on maternity leave. She's through the glass in front of us here. We wish you all the best. And remember, it's this. When the time comes. I'm Bob Oakes, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.